I have a presentation which I think the media has got. It's a PowerPoint presentation. I'm not going to present it as a PowerPoint presentation. And anybody else who needs it should get it. And I wonder if everybody can copy it off the annual report as well. I'll try not to spend too much time on this. It's a 40-page annual report, and it doesn't have a lot of padding, so there's a lot of content in the report itself. It's difficult to summarize in a few minutes, but I'll see what I can do. Also, just bearing in mind that not everybody is familiar with the background to the JIPSA project, I'll say a few words about the background. For those of you who don't know, the JIPSA stands for the Joint Initiative for Priority Skills Acquisition, and it arose from the decision of the government after wide consultation to establish a program called ASGISA, the Accelerated and Shared Growth Initiative for South Africa. ASGISA was launched approximately, well, two and a bit years ago, essentially at the beginning of 2006, by the Deputy President, with the objective of implementing and achieving the mandate of the government, which was to halve poverty and halve unemployment between 2004 and 2014, reduce unemployment from to below 15%, the level at the time was about 28%, and to halve poverty. And the belief was, having done the calculations about the relationship between growth and employment creation, that with effective shared growth, we would be able to achieve this if we had an average growth rate of about 4.5% up to 2009, and then from 2010 onwards, an average growth rate of 6% or higher. The ASGISA identified six constraints on growth, on effective shared growth. Now, we won't go into all of them at this launch. We are going to be launching the ASGISA annual report tomorrow, and there obviously we'll go into more detail on the other aspects of ASGISA. But amongst the six constraints, the issue of the shortage of skills was considered to be of such a high priority that it was decided to establish a semi-autonomous or special initiative comprised of stakeholders to drive the skills acquisition program. The JIPSA was launched in March 2006 with all the major stakeholders on board. That would be the senior government ministers from key departments, education, science and technology, labour and so on, the business sector, CEOs of many important companies, the education sector, vice chancellors and leaders of other educational institutions, and labour, trade union leaders. The rationale for a joint initiative was that although, as I've already mentioned, unemployment in South Africa was high and remains high, skills at all levels, from operator, technician, and artisan upwards, are in short supply in South Africa. And we anticipated that if we achieved the levels of growth that we were aiming for, that those shortages could become more severe. The first task of JIPSA was to elevate the skills issues to the top of the national agenda. the purpose, the rationale for JIPSA was not to change long-term policies. That's the responsibility of government, the government department, processes which take time and respond to long-term issues. The focus of JIPSA was short to medium-term intervention to remove the obstacles to growth that came from the shortage of skills. In some cases, that might influence longer-term policy development as well, but that wasn't the main intention of JIPSA. And obviously, there are projects that are driven by governments, there are projects that are driven by other stakeholders, business, for example, and many partnerships between the various key partners in the program. The approach, after we canvassed this, we found that the approach was widely supported, and it was very well supported from the moment of the launch. The modality was that JIPSA would target a limited number of priority skills, which are thought to be some of the key constraints on growth, to base the intervention on the findings of high quality research. So we were able to find facilities that would support research into, say, the question of artisans or the question of engineers, to quantify the problem, to identify the key possible areas in which those problems would be solved. So there was a very strong empirical scientific base to the way that we approach solving the problem. It operates on the basis of what we've come to call the voluntary self-binding of autonomous project owners. Now, that sounds funny. But what it means is that, say, the Department of Labor is a project owner of the program to increase the production of artisans, to facilitate the more rapid production of artisans, which was one of the fundamental challenges. They would have to change the regulatory environment, the laws. They would have to make sure that the National Skills Fund money is channeled in the right direction, that the teachers understand the targets and so on. That's their job, primarily. But they recognize that they're working with a whole series of partners and labor and business and so on. So they made commitments through JIPSA to all the other members of the partnership that they would achieve their objectives by a certain point. And then they drove those projects, obviously, with a keen observation of the other members of the partnership. So it's voluntary. Nobody told the, well, perhaps the deputy president did, but it's both voluntary in the sense that the minister, as the really autonomous leader of his portfolio, might have his own timetable and agenda, but he agreed this would be part of the JIPSA program and we would bind ourselves to a certain timetable. The same for projects in the education department, projects driven by business. So it's the voluntary self-binding, the projects are relatively autonomous because they're driven by this or that institution, but their commitment to the connectors. The moral and practical support of the other stakeholders is obviously key to the success of the program, and equally the committed and visible leadership of the Deputy President is a key element of the success of the program. The fact that we have, through those leaders in the stakeholder groups and the Deputy President, elevated the program to the prominence that it has in the national agenda, I think has underpinned the success, has supported the success. Now, I have a diagram in this presentation which I thought you might all be able to see, but you can't. The structure of JIPSA, so I'll just describe it very briefly. The leading the JIPSA under the chairpersonship of the Deputy President is the task team. And that task team consists of ministers, business leaders, labor leaders, education leaders. Supporting that task team are the senior experts or officials in those different institutions, the labor policy people in the trade unions, the policy people in government, the strategy people in business, and so on. And that they form the technical working group, the JIPSA technical working group. And that's where a lot of the research is commissioned and analyzed before it is taken to the joint task team for decision. The the system as a, and obviously there are inputs from various sources, there are commissioned inputs, there are workshops, there are consultations of various kinds, and all held together by something called the Justice Secretariat, which is a group of people located at the NDI, the National Business Initiative, and funded by the Business Trust, which supports the program. There's obviously been a lot of international and local support to the JIFSA program from various countries that are partners with us in the program, where we are able to send people for training, domestic and international businesses which are also participating in on-the-job training programs of various kinds. Now, the priorities in the first phase, and the first phase of JIFSA ended late last year, and that's what essentially what the annual report focused on were. First of all, and I'm going to run through them fairly quickly, they're obviously in the report in much more detail. Engineers, the production of engineers. We have a lot of investment. The key ingredient to growth was going to be the fact that we could invest, government could invest in roads and electricity and water and housing and so on, in order to increase the capacity of the economy. The private sector has to invest in productive capacity, in equipment, in telecommunication systems, and all the things that the private sector does. And in order to do all of those investments, you need engineers. In order to manage and maintain those investments, you need engineers. And we found that early in this decade, the output of engineers of our education system were very low. By the time we got to 2007, the output of engineers had already increased to about 1,500 per annum of, from a low point of about 1,200 per annum at the beginning of the decade. And our target that we set then for the output of engineers was that we wanted to get it up to an additional 1,000 per annum, take it up to 2,500 per annum as soon as possible. Now what we have got, the commitment we have got from the university system and the education department is that by 2,000, the output will be 2,000 per annum, which is almost double what it was at the beginning of the decade, and it's 500 more than it was at the beginning of the JIFSA program. So that's a really important development. Although it's not enough, it's a very significant commitment and an improvement in our performance. As far as artisans are concerned, the assessment made at the beginning of the project was that we needed an additional 50,000 more artisans than we expected to have by 2010. And the target was to increase the output of artisans by the rate of about 12 or 13,000 a year. Now, the Department of Labor has done a lot of work in this area, and they've amended the skills development goal. They've published new training routes for artisans in public comment, and those will be about to be finalized. And they've set much higher targets for the output of artisans, even above the 12,000 a year that we originally did. They've set it at 18,000 for the current financial year and 20,000 for the financial year coming. For the 18,000 for the past financial year, 2007-08, and 20,000 for the current financial year ending at the end of March 2009. And they've done that through diverting various additional funds to the teachers and other training agencies from the National Skills Fund, and also getting the teachers to submit appropriate resources. Another very important development in the area of technical skills has been the commitment of two business leadership South Africa, of the CEOs of developing companies, to a commitment on increasing the output of skills by companies. And one of the business programs is the Technical Business Skills Partnership, which is run by business. So those are two really big areas, engineers and artisans, perhaps the core of the project. Other really important areas were the area of city and regional planning skills. A lot of the investment, particularly by the state, municipal, provincial and national government, involved urban development, rural development, spatial development, and we found we didn't have nearly enough planners. People used to make plans for towns or cities or municipalities or districts, and also to approve projects within those plans. You have to have people with appropriate skills. So what we discovered now, and this I think shows the flexibility of the justice program, what we discovered was it wasn't that we weren't producing enough planners, it was that planners weren't encouraged to stay in the profession. That the conditions of employment for professional planners in the places of work, provinces, municipalities and so on, weren't appropriate. Planners didn't have the kind of recognition that they deserved, and therefore, instead of actually attacking the problem at the point of production of planners, the problem was more, how do we improve the career path for planners? How do we get the professional association, the relevant government organization, their employers in government to improve the conditions for planners? We also engaged in work on management and planning skills in education and health, and gave some assistance and support to the relevant departments in improving those systems. In mathematics, science and ICT competence in public schooling, there was already a set of initiatives from the education department, of which the best known is the Denaledi School program, and just to find ways to give additional support to the education department in that. There were also a number of sectoral projects, as DISA had identified a number of sectors which, because they were rapidly growing sectors and sectors which were relatively labour-intensive, were suitable for governments to try to find ways to encourage the development of, not really, but not by financial incentives so much as by removing obstacles and improving the regulatory environment. And in these areas, very often, skills were a constraint as well. So, in business process outsourcing, there was one of the key elements of a successful business process outsourcing industry. And just to explain that briefly, business process outsourcing is where the back offices or the front offices of business, in other words, the people who process claims of insurance or who manage the accounts for banks, or in the front office, who do the call centers, who respond to complaints or help people with their service inquiries and so on. All of those activities don't have to take place in any particular place. And as many of you know, in the ICT sector, India has become very strong in back office operations. South Africa has a lot of capacity, particularly in the financial sector, to grow business process outsourcing. And there are a number of international investments in this, as well as by big South African companies. The key ingredient is trained people. So after quite a lot of discussion and identification of opportunities in the Department of Labour, established a program called the Moneta program to support training in that sector, which is currently supporting training in that sector. There are also training projects in the various provinces through funding from the Central Skills Fund. Tourism is also an area which was identified as labor intensive and growing, and there the JIFTA program supported the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism in improving the environment for training in that sector. In ICT, we realized that there were opportunities in ICT and information and communication technology sectors, which continue to be major growing sectors on their own and supporters of other sectors' growth. But when the E-Skills Council was established, arising out of the Presidential International Advisory Council on Information Society and Development, the responsibility for the ICT program was handed over to the E-Skills Council. So we did a bit of work and handed over what we'd done to them. And they, I think, are progressing very well. The fourth area was biofuels. As you know, a couple of years ago, we identified biofuels as a potential area for very rapid growth, and the government has established a framework for the development of the biofuel sector, although we were quite slow about it, deliberately slow, because it was recognized as we were progressing through the biofuel strategy that there were certain quite serious pitfalls that could arise, particularly in terms of the availability and the prices of food. So we've come up with a fairly conservative biofuel program. It's key area of opportunity in biofuel is in supporting small and emerging farmers and supplying the inputs into the biofuel sector. And that raises the question, which I'll come back to a little bit later, that the opportunity for training in the agricultural sector, which is increasingly recognized as an important area. Some of our other achievements, or just as other achievements, there's some work done towards developing a national skills and education database, with some research work supporting SACRA and development institutions. There's a very substantial work placement program. Work placement has two elements. The one element is placing unemployed graduates in experiential opportunities and employment in South Africa. And there, South African firms have volunteered. In the report, you'll see an identification of many of the firms that have made a significant contribution to the placement program. And then internationally, firms and governments have helped us to place South Africans and significantly quite a large number of black women in employment opportunities in order to accelerate their experience, their achievement of experience, basically expose them to other ways of doing things, the kinds of things that they would come back in and be expected to achieve more than they would have had they not had that experience. So there are these international placements and domestic placements. And in total, we've had about, well, more than 20,000 offers. At the time that we compiled the report, about 14,000 graduates had been placed in South Africa, and more than 700 had been placed abroad. The challenge is to strengthen those structures, because we do think that they have very positive as well. So the support structures, both for the domestic and international placement, have to be strengthened further. We also have the Sienza Manje project, which is a project run by the Development Bank, the DBSA, which currently has 118 formerly retired professionals who they have placed at 101 municipalities around the country to help the municipalities with their investment and maintenance programs, and also has deployed young black professionals as the understudies of these experienced retired professionals so that we are creating human capital as we go along. And Sienza Manje has an additional something like 800 CVs which it has received and is processing. Now, just to talk a little bit about that's the main content of the achievements part of the report. Just to reflect a little bit on the key elements of how wide just the work. Essentially, it's a partnership, a real social partnership, and it's based very firmly on the commitment of the ministers, of the trade union leaders, of the CEOs, and of the educational leaders to the program. This has given just a strong base and access to very important offices. Secondly, we have this project owners and autonomy modality that just the partners have agreed to make commitments under the observation of the partners that driving projects on their own and to report from time to time appropriately in that context. And that has been a very kind of a context in which the partners have been able to encourage each other to achieve and celebrate each other's achievements. And finally, that it's a problem-solving approach. It's an approach where problems are not that difficult to identify, and then there's an empirical process of gathering evidence, discussing it at the technical working group level, discussing it at the joint task team level, and then making decisions on the basis of good evidence. And finally, the way forward. In November 2007, last year, the JIPSA joint task team held a bush barrage, which wasn't actually in the bush, it was in the presidential guest house, and the leaders of the JIPSA project participated in good numbers and good spirit, and agreed that the initial 18-month period of the JIPSA program should be extended for at least another 18 months, which takes JIPSA to the end of March 2009. And that was on the basis of reports which basically identified what the successes and achievements or otherwise of JIPSA had been. The business trust agreed to renew its funding commitment to the JIPSA Secretariat, which is quite a strong organization, and I think a very important one. And you'll be introduced to a member of it shortly. And then most of the key projects that I mentioned continue. Some of those which are mature enough to be handed over to the project owners, they don't need any JIFTA involvement anymore, would be passed on. And then there might be one or two new areas of work as well. The JIFTA, during past senior meeting this afternoon, to make decisions. But it's very likely that one additional area of work will be in the area of agriculture, training, and extension services, where I think there's a wide recognition that there's a very significant gap at the moment that JIFTA can help fill. And finally, the continued support of leaders in government, labor, business, and education, and the training sector is greatly valued, and we think the report will show that this is the key to strategic perspective. I'm now going to hand over briefly to Makamo Morojele, who's the head of the JIFTA Secretary, just to say a couple of words.
Thank you, Ryan. I think Ryan has really covered most of the key issues, but perhaps I just want to add one or two things. The first being that this has succeeded to create a new space for ongoing dialogue between business, government, organized labor, professional bodies. And within that work, it has highlighted the need for collaborative action in terms of responding to the skills challenges. I think it's also important to recognize the leadership of the presidency, particularly the deputy president and the JCP, and the peer leadership and that of the JCP has been quite critical to the success of this. And in terms of going forward, as Alan has indicated, a much more effective JIFTA will require the leadership of the project owners. I think that will raise some interesting questions about how we begin to institutionalize this collaborative action, and that it should become an integral part of how we approach skills development. The Secretariat will be taking a proposal to the JCP in the next while for its consideration and approval, and we will be looking quite closely at the current work, but in particular looking at what can be achieved in the time frame. Those are the few remarks that I would like to make.
That name is on
movers and takers, the secretariat in particular, the JCP members, partners in the private sector, the departments that are involved and the ones that are secondary, but nevertheless supportive of the ones that are in the cutting edge of this work, such as DOE and DOL, and of course also our partners in labor. It's important to highlight that in this area of skills, when we started and identified skills as a binding constraint to the growth of the economy, the world has changed dramatically since that time. Whatever we were concerned about in terms of the scale of the problem, it's actually become bigger in the interim. So there's actually a need for us to up our game, to mobilize even stronger between and among the colleagues. And I think in the intervening period, one thing that we've been able to do is to develop a framework within which to work to address the things that we we need to address them in this stuff. So I think the message to the colleagues in this stuff is that we've got more work estimates. I know we've done a lot of work, but what do you get from that? More work. You know, no peace for the weekend. But also, if you look at some of the challenges that the world is facing, food crisis, the issue of fuel and power in the state of South Africa, as well as the skill issue. So these issues are in the same level, level of importance for South Africa, for the world. So also part of what we are having to do as a government, as South Africa, including all other stakeholders, is to think about South Africa, but also understand the global context. And to the extent that we can also reach out to other countries who are addressing similar problems and learn and share lessons, we think that this is also an important part of something that needs to be alive, so that we don't work like a silo as a country or as this stuff, while we do not take into account what is happening inside us, what is happening in the world. In that regard, we are aware that we certainly are having a difference in terms of the skills that we are using as a country, and therefore that also means that the work of GIPSA, the work of the relevant department, even becomes more complicated. So if you look behind me, business as usual, all hands on the deck, to see that change, there isn't enough hands on the deck yet. So part of what we have to do is mobilize more hands on the deck so that we can address this challenge that we are talking about. We have been talking about the need to resolve this better, to make the secretariat more agile, so that issues of accessing resources, either from government or from the other partner, does not become by itself a constraint, because that just makes them lose too much work. And we have the ear of the Minister of Finance on this issue. So hopefully, following due process, we should be able to assist Mr. Acker. Hope that he's not going to take the money from the side of the president. But if so, why not? So we'll just cut Alan's salary and mine and put it to Mr. I also just want to acknowledge the fact that in the interim, a very important initiative which maybe hasn't as yet received enough attention is that of the South African Business Leadership, who is a partner to GIPSA. I think that in the last few months they've been working on this thing, and maybe during the Q&A they can say a little bit more, because I don't think that we've had a situation in South Africa where senior business leadership has been so focused on the issue of skills. I think the fact that today the senior leadership in South African business is here, Pat Davis, Sarko, Yako Mares, and again, Maria Kampnet, Bobby, Gostel, is an indication of just how far we have gone. And of course, also the construction industry, which has also come to the party in a strong way. We have in the interim lost an important member of the GIPSA team, Gwede Mantashe, who was the representative of labor. But he will be replaced by Baby Zalizali, who unfortunately is away in India right now, but has accepted to replace Gwede. Tomorrow when we have the Afghiza meeting, Gwede will come to make his farewell speech, and we'll hand over to Beijing as an adventure. But it's good that there is that continuity and interest also within Lima. Just to highlight some of the things that Alex mentioned, we need skills. In the issue of engineers and accidents, I think we have now about 18,000. Accidents if I'm saying for the 2007-2008 period. We want to reach 50,000 accidents by 2010, and there actually isn't no room for us not to achieve that. So in fact we actually need more. So I'm just saying that to the extent that they are initiated by some provinces, by companies, especially those who use artisans, we actually need to make sure that they stay the course. I'm also aware that in relation to the artisans, the Department of Labor and the Department of Education have covered a lot of ground in ensuring that the regulatory environment is improved and ensuring that the students, whether they are in MPT or they are in learnership, everybody knows what kind of a qualification they will have and that it has value in the market. I'm sure that in the next few months we'll continue to find things that there's a lot of the work that we didn't have when we started with this study has already been done and the agreements were reached between private sector and government in this regard. An area, however, in which we think that we need to do more work is the training the trainer. We need to support the training of the teachers who are teaching in SEC because the response and the number of students that we've adopted there is quite significant. But there is room for us to improve the quality of teaching there. So this is another area in which this, together with the relevant department, is paying attention. We had ICT as an important part of VISTA as a sector, but also linked to the DPO industry, which has matured, and we are actually feeling that VISTA doesn't have to be active in that space because business trust, DCI, Department of Labor are running with that. We were able in the VISTA process as well as working with the other stakeholders to sort out the challenges that we have there. And in the process, we have established an ICT e-skills council, which again will take over the work of ICT training. It's the area that we have been involved in, because that has brought together private sector in a big way. And I think on their own, they'll be giving the support. Of course, the Department of Education continues to be a party to this, but it is very good that in the interim, we're going to be producing thousands of ICT experts, which will not only depend on what the universities can do, but in what the universities can do together with industry. We have made a strategic choice. That's why we have not given up on biofuels or sensitive to the food issues, and therefore the training that we're encouraging is not just about biofuels, but the generic workers in the agricultural sector, and we have seen that about 500 workers are going to be trained, and we're hoping to increase the numbers so that there will be more people that can feed in the street. The issue of foreign recruitment has become very urgent because as we see the shortage that we have, we realize that we do not have time to train our people the way we want to. I mean, we don't have the luxury of time. And therefore, the work that we have in is doing in Sierra Leone, which now is benefiting about more than 100 municipalities, in the sense that in each of those municipalities we have placed people. We have got a significant number of people in the main with a background in finance from all mutuals that are also placed in different municipalities under their program that is called ILIMA. But also we have, for instance, for a company like ESCOM, been supporting foreign recruitment, which is currently taking place. I know that my government has got this morning in New York and London to do recruitment for ESCOM, and we see that there's need for us to do a lot of that, and they found a lot of South Africans that are coming back home. But I was told that the instructions are that you recruit, you offer, and those who can take back what you take back. Those who can't take back, you give them a ticket, so that as you learn, they are on their way. So I hope that you're able to carry the instructions. In the area of public education, Alan made reference to the Nalini schools, but also there's another program called Adopt a School. That also will enable us to collaborate with the Department of Education to look at what is happening in every school and to mobilize support so that we can bring the level of education and learning and teaching conditions in each of these disadvantaged schools, especially to a level that will support and give us, that will support the school and give us the appropriate quality of learning. In working on the area of placement of graduates, we have also noticed that actually we need to pay attention also to the curriculum. And therefore, we have established a relationship with the retained sector team, for instance, to address the placement of the matric students. And we're seeing there an opportunity to recruit a lot of great health graduates who are not going to university or further training for all kinds of reasons. However, we are arguing with the Department of Education that those that have dropped out of school, for instance, the fourth grade child, must go back to school. We do not want to fight that issue because they are just swelling the rank of the unemployment, of the unemployed, and they definitely need no possibility for those people to have a meaningful kind of life going on if they do not go back to school. This is something that we just like to answer. Not necessarily a deeper area, a focus area, but certainly it's an area that was very much concerned and interested in. So we are just adding that that call must be made that those who have dropped out of school must go back to school, finish their grade 12, and try to acquire additional skills so that then they can face the labor market from a greater a position of strength. In the work placement for new graduates and new career professionals, we have received tremendous help again from private sector and from our overseas partners. Recently, when I was in Holland, I was really happy to meet the different, with the funding for the different companies which hosted our students there, mainly in ICT, in water related technical areas, as well as in creative arts. And all of them, without exception, were just saying that it's been a wonderful experience to have those young people that are there, but they just were saying that the time is actually crucial. We need to reconsider how long the session. What was nice is also to know that some of them are intending to come and start businesses in South Africa because they have a contact person who they understand they would like to further work with, and through them they are hoping to expand in their companies. And some companies are invited to students back for further training because they felt that just when they got to know the students and they felt that they knew how far they could take the students, the program was such that they had to come back. So they're inviting them back. And some students are paying on their own to actually go back so that they can achieve further training. And we're quite happy with that. I also had an opportunity recently to participate in the Nelson Mandela Road Foundation program, which is not a digital program, it's a separate program, but obviously one that we also have an interest in. And to note there that we've got 70 South African students who are doing postgraduate studies in Oxford was something that was quite heartwarming. And all of them were interested to know how can they help to participate in this as a community of scholars so that when they come back, they can continue as the Mandela scholars to play a significant role. So this is the kind of thing that we would like to encourage and see with many of our students. The DIPSA Secretariat has got to work in all kinds of ways. They are the secretariat, they have to be experts. It really is a lot, and it's just to coordinate very powerful people, and sometimes that is not easy. I just like to commend them for the way they are able to carry on their task, and I'd like to commend the officials from the different departments who are able to fit into their business and usual space of work, because we are in a way, in our own right, establishing a way of working in a multi-sectoral manner. And of course, the fact that we are able to call on senior leaders in business does mean that we can, in a way, fast track some of this decision making where we need the partners to come on board. So, as the presidency who has had the responsibility to be associated with this initiative and to drive it. I would prefer to say that we want more, we want scale, but also I think that it is unfair if one did not appreciate and acknowledge that a lot of work is going into this, and that the people who are working in the program have really gone an extra mile to make sure that they have got a fruitful engagement, and all those hours of work and paper that, you know, happens.
For other partners to come on board and to assist us in increasing
the number of people that say that we can train. The opportunities in South Africa for people to advance in the area that they are in are quite attractive for some of the people. But really, I don't think that we have got a magic wand that will enable us to keep people. Just to make the challenge that we are going to continue to face, we've got to continue to improve conditions of service, but the supply side is actually quite critical. And looking at what the Department of Education is doing, starting from public school level, that is about a bigger push so that the supply side is greatly enhanced. I would ask the other two to answer the other question.
I think that it's quite critical that the retention of professional schools, particularly in education and housing, has been a focus point. There's quite a number of skills in education that are likely ongoing in healthcare also. And part of the arrangement is exactly that, I think, as identified. One of the ways of retaining those particular schools and attracting people back into those particular areas is the remuneration, and I think that's been a concern. But over and above that, I think it's more about also the type of conditions that workers in those particular sectors work in, particularly teachers having to deal with more general issues, both in schooling, issues in relation to how they deal with type of services that they deliver at a hospital, for example. And I think these are part of an ongoing discussion with organized labor, and I think it's an important area that we need to look at. So one on the one, and I think it's important to note that the remuneration plays an important component. The other relates to having a satisfied professional worker in education and health.
The trust is providing a total of 16 million rand up to March 2009. Yes, the money is mainly to support the activities of the secretariat. I mean, clearly where there are projects, that money has to be sought elsewhere. And as the DC has indicated earlier, she is talking to the Minister of Finance to seek additional funding for the digital work.
I need to emphasize that the money for just activities depend on the budget of the partners, because we are supporting the work that is already budgeted for and is provided for by the department. For instance, engineers, that is the Department of Education budget. They are the ones that are supporting the universities. When we talk about providing more graduates, it is the Department of Education that has ensured that we've got more money to support the training of academically competent and financially needy students. There's been a significant increase in that regard. So whatever we'll be able to do at this, we will never replace the enormous resources that are actually coming from line department. So I think it's important to make that point.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter.
Okay, yes.
It's Carol Payton from the Financial Mail. You talked about the targets for artisans, but you never mentioned how many were actually produced, what was actually produced when it came to artisans for the last year. Secondly, were the FET college results a setback for GIPSA, given that they were very poor? And thirdly, what are you doing to promote South Africa as an immigration destination? You know, countries like Australia have these massive expos where employers and the governments and all sorts of people can promote immigration to South Africans. They just had one here last month. Are you thinking of doing similar things at all? Thanks.
Yes, Kath from City Press newspaper. Following up on the FET College's question, it says here that the target is for 2,500 engineers per year. How do you then hope to do that in a country that is producing very little maths and science passes at higher grade level?
Christelle Tablange from Independent Newspapers. In terms of the targets, the MDG targets for 2014, if we are going to import so many skills, will we be able to meet those in terms of unemployment and poverty?
Indeed, it is. We can answer.
The world has changed, the Deputy President said, since GIPSA started. It's changed very dramatically in the last 3 to 6 months. And I just returned from a week in the United States. And I want to tell you, a large part of the world is ex-growth. A large part of the developed world is heading for recession, or is already in recession. And actually, in the next, in my view, 5 to 10 years, the most dramatic real economic growth is going to happen in emerging markets. So really there's a sentiment amongst investors that is incredibly positive towards investing in investing markets. In that context, Africa as a continent has never been more positively received. In the 34 years that I've been talking to investing people in the Northern Hemisphere, up until now they've always had reasons, many of them quite serious, for not being that interested in Africa. We've got massive infrastructural programs underway. There's good governance reforms in most of the continent, and we know that there are one or two important exceptions, and we as a continent need to deal with that. But I've never seen a sentiment as positive as it is. And you know, the most important thing that people follow, individual human beings follow, is opportunity. So you know, I actually think we're going to start seeing a return flow of engineers. In the financial services sector, I mean, I say this not to persuade Jack to increase my overdraft, or I don't have one. I'd love him to increase it anyway. But I mean, we have a sound financial services sector in South Africa. The fourth largest investment bank in the United States just got sold to another bank. The initial offer was a quarter of the value of their corporate office in Manhattan. It's amazing. The largest mortgage lender in Britain just got nationalized. And not actually, I'm doing myself. So, you know, we're living in a different time, and we should catch on to this. I mean, now more than ever, we have real challenges, real infrastructural growth, real economic growth. We are less indebted than most of the rich parts of the world, in part because the rich part of the world wouldn't lend us money, and thank God that they didn't. We've got a healthier set of economic fundamentals, and that's what's going to bring people back. The last thing I want to say, you know, what we do need to do is we need to be a foreign-friendly country. And that needs to start with our own continent, but it needs to go beyond our own continent. The people coming here, bringing their work and their courage and their enterprise and their risk-taking, are a huge benefit to South Africa.
Thank you.
With regard to FET colleges, you might be aware of the fact that you've introduced 11 new programs in the FET colleges, in the NYCC, and tourism, etc. Now, the performance in the FET sector has been. The only area of difficulty has been mathematics, that mathematical literacy is a fundamental, it's compulsory subject, and to that end, we provide additional support. But if you look at the overall pass rate in all the other learning areas, it has been extremely good. So we are not discouraged, we recognize challenges in terms of mathematics and science, and we do believe that we're doing extremely well in the actual colleges in terms of our collaborating with the business sector, in terms of the IT capacity that we provided in the ICT colleges, and ICT is doing extremely well, and in terms of the uptake quality program, we've projected 40,000 for next year, we've already surpassed it to 50,000, which is an endemic start. With regard to labor itself, in terms of artisans, in terms of information that is available, there are 18,000 artisans that have been produced in the labor sector. With regard to mathematics and science, this is indeed a key challenge. We are aware of the fact that mathematical literacy is a fundamental subject. That means that translates into the fact that every learner in our school system would be doing either mathematics or mathematical literacy. It's very, very exciting. Given the fact that last year we had approximately 600,000 learners that have accepted for mathematics. Now, from the projections and the analysis that we've done, approximately 50% of them would be doing mathematics, and the other 50% has mathematical literacy. That in itself would directly result in an increase in the performance in mathematics and science. Now, what is the increase in relation to the participation rate in mathematics? We have approximately 35,000 students or learners with written mathematics in the standard grade, and we achieve between A, B, and C, and approximately 6,800 from the learners that have written in the standard grade have a distinction in the standard grade mathematics. One of the difficulties that we face is the psychological barrier that mathematics is difficult and the learners cannot achieve. Indeed, the results is prove otherwise that where they are, where they really do participate in mathematics, they will indeed be able to achieve. This year, there will not be standard grade higher grade. Is going to be established in the paper this year, and we do believe that with the support that we provide, particularly to our university schools where we are providing additional teachers, equipment, tech, etc., that there should be a medical shift in the number. That would be an important challenge that we cannot do. Thank you very much.
The United Schools are a direct link to feed into the system so that we're able to produce engineers and people who are technicians. So we are paying attention to the fact that we want to produce engineers, we want people who are technically competent, and therefore we need to take a step back and address the pipeline from high school. And the documents I have given you some of the figures. The teachers also were asked to reinvent some of their funding in order to address the issue of training of artisans. So we've seen some of the increase in the training of artisans because many of the teachers reprioritize their funding in order to support the artisans. And that is why we are saying that in 2007-2008 we are expecting an output of 18,000 because of the combined efforts of FETs, of CTAs, of private sector, and all of that has given us that number. I don't know if Mr. Wani was in the construction industry, for whom this is a bit of a heading, also wants to say anything on that.
With the relationship that the construction industry had with the FET colleges, it worked very well. It's important that we as the potential employers get to understand that the colleges and help them, and that there's cross pollination. So we've also had quite a lot of input on the changing the curriculum to make them more user friendly and applicable to the construction industry. So I think it was going on in the other industries as well. So yes, I think we'd be very happy with the way that the colleges are doing.
There's
some
issue of interesting skills and the impact on our target for job creation, the kind of skills that you are actually imparting or bringing from the talent are skills you don't have. And because you don't have those senior skills, then you cannot employ the large numbers of people who are semi-skilled or unskilled or mid-career. So you actually do need the senior people in order to create jobs. Without them, you even have a greater problem, because you cannot reach and keep with produce our own before you actually can make the progress that you are doing. So I don't think that there's a contradiction. The number of people that you are ever going to import is always going to be insignificant, but strategic and therefore relevant for you to create a local job. Just to emphasize that on the issue of engineers that we are targeting in our document, we focus on what we need to produce as a country, but we are not expecting these numbers only to be the responsibility of the university. We are expecting and are working with private sector and other service providers to participate in the training. And we have seen an increase in the support that is available to train engineers inside and outside South Africa. I know that companies like Telkom are also exploring doing their own training, their own institutions, so that they are able to get up and support the university.
We really need to end this. The quality system is really, really important. We'll just take that one, and then we'll have to say there is an opportunity to ask more questions tomorrow at the official on 11 o'clock at the paper. So we'll deal with that as well. We'll take your talent and end it there.
It is okay, Denzel. The question is covered.
Certainly, entry-level IT workers we don't have to import, because we can train them in South Africa. And that is what the initiative and the collaboration with the ICT company is all about. At a higher level, there may be a higher cost of who you export because of the complexity of the skills that they're looking for. So the percentage cannot be across the board. The more complex it gets, the more we are likely to increase the percentage of people that we are importing. But the bulk of the skills are people that we have to train in South Africa, and that is how we're structuring our collaboration in that area of training. I think the universities as well have upped their game in the training of ICT, so some of those numbers we would expect that our universities would be able to push in, especially your undergrads and so on. Technicons at technical universities are also doing a lot in that area.
I just add to this, and I think the deputy president is correct. It depends on the level of the skill. In the FT College, for example, every learner has to do ICT. So all learners that are enrolled in 11 programs would have to be proficient in ICT. The council that Ellen has spoken about has looked at the matter very carefully to say, what are the actual ICT needs in the different sectors? So we have to look at the construction industry, we have to look at service industry, etc. And it's going to basically engage with the different sectors in commerce to find out precisely what is the nature of the skill, what is the level of the skill required, and what is going to be developed. The Deputy President has alluded to the private sector as well. They've already learned an ICT college established by the private sector, in which all Microsoft, HP, etc. are participants for a program, and they agree that in collaboration with the Department of Education. So there's a lot happening in the ICT arena. It's a question of identifying particular skills, and where they are not available, high level skills might not be available outside, you might get them inside the mentoring takes place only at the same time. Thank you very much. Thank you. For those who will be joining us tomorrow at the Epiphanon, if that's a guest start, then it's 11 o'clock, and we will see you there, and we'll have opportunities again for further questions. Thank you, Tekka. We'll close it there. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.